Friends, it's 32 years this week that suddenly the guardian of the cause disappeared from our midst. It was a shattering experience for the Baha'is who were alive and conscious in those days of what the implications of that loss were and would be for the Baha'i world. It's very difficult, I think, to project ourselves back into those times if one hasn't lived the experience of being in the community and receiving the messages of Shoghi Effendi. They would arrive, these cables, world-shaking cables, really, about the progress of the faith and important developments in the cause. And there would be a stir in the whole community. I remember I was a new Baha'i in California, and Baha'i youth, and they didn't wait for the next meeting to read the message. Immediately it was electric all over that a message had arrived from the guardian, and the friends would be gathering in the center that night to hear the message. That was the way it was. So everybody would rearrange their affairs and be there to hear the message if they could. And that was the last year, these messages of the last year of the guardian's life, particularly dramatic messages. And one of them was in June 1957. It had to do with the battle that the Baha'is, the forces of light, were engaged in with the forces of darkness. And Shoghi Effendi spoke there of this encounter, this contest that was taking place between the hosts of the Lord, animated by His Spirit, His divine energies, and those hosts of the world animated by the low and base qualities of human existence. We know how the battle ends, but we can't clearly visualize the ferocity of the contest or the stages and development of the scenario between now and then. Some hints have been given to us in the writings of our faith, indications, promises, prophecies. A vision fires us as we enter into a study of the writings, a vision of the future. An examination of these forces of light and darkness as they're described in the writings was something that caught my attention some years ago, and I began as best I could to try to understand this subject and to gather various extracts and passages from the writings that mention them, putting them together, juxtaposing them next to each other, trying to understand what the fuller picture which emerges when one gathers various texts and begins considering, weighing, pondering how they relate to each other and what the fuller image is that's inherent in these writings. And I began then to try to understand something of this subject. Now, really what I'm sharing tonight is more my own thoughts on the matter. You have to go back to the texts and search for them yourselves, or perhaps you've already done so and you have your own understanding of the subject. So just remember that some of the things that I'll say are based on the text, and other things are based on my vain imaginings, and you'll know how to distinguish, I'm sure, between the two. You'll forgive me for the limits of my concepts, but at the same time I think it's a very stimulating exercise to examine a few of these quotations and to think, what is it that Shoghi Effendi is trying to tell us? And actually, for me, I think that this is one of the greatest keys in understanding of this subject, to understanding the writings of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá. If you want to understand about a subject, Shoghi Effendi once asked the pilgrims, should you turn to the writings of Baha'u'llah or to Abdu'l-Bahá? They said Baha'u'llah. He said Abdu'l-Bahá. Now we say Shoghi Effendi. It's not complete, you know. The interpreter clarifies the meaning of the original. That if we just had the original without the interpretations, we wouldn't understand it as clearly. So if we look back through the lens, through the clarity that Shoghi Effendi provides us, then we begin to see the implications of Baha'u'llah's writings in a clearer way, especially for the period that we're living in now and passing through at this time, to which he referred so often in his writings, both Baha'u'llah and then Shoghi Effendi in his explanations, and Abdu'l-Bahá in the center with so many tablets on the same subjects. We have a quote, for example, from Baha'u'llah, which heightens our awareness of the greatness of the day we live in. And we know many passages like this. He says, "This is the day in which God's most excellent favors have been poured out upon men. The day in which His most mighty grace hath been infused into all created things." He talks about having endowed every single letter with regenerative power. He talks about this bringing into existence a new creation, a creation the magnitude of which is inscrutable to all save God. He talks about breathing a new life into every human frame. He talks about instilling into every word a fresh potency. He says that should the word be allowed to release suddenly all the energies latent within it, no man could sustain the weight of so mighty a revelation. Even in these brief words, we begin to conceive of revelation in two ways. On the one hand, it is a revealing of holy texts, of divine words, of heavenly guidance. On the other hand, it is a revelation of spirit, power, energy from the manifestation of God. The Bab links these two together in one of his expressions, where he says, "No word is revealed from the lordly tree, the tree of life, if you will, except that at the same moment the power is created for its accomplishment, or the power is released for the accomplishment of whatever that divine word states." In the Old Testament, it says that the word of God does not return to him void. It is not going to lose its power. It is going to go and do what it's supposed to do. A lot is said in the writings about potentialities, latent potentialities. This also has its application at an individual level and at a societal level. Individually, he says, we have these tremendous potentialities, talents, capacities latent within each of us in our own inner reality, and that these are much like a lamp with oil and a wick that requires fire to reveal its purpose. Now, what is a lamp and oil and wick if there's no light from it? All of this that's been placed within us under the influence of the fire of the revelation of God is ignited, and then that energy is released. All of what has been placed within human society in the form of the energies of this revelation that's there latent, the whole design of the future, the whole pattern for the development of a world civilization, requires instruments through which it can express itself. The world order of Baha'u'llah lives in the hearts and souls of the Baha'is. As much as it sounds like it's made up of institutions, when we analyze it, those institutions are made up of faithful believers. And it is their association in conformity with the instructions of the Prophet of God that allows these energies of various degrees and natures to be released into the world and to set in motion processes for the accomplishment of the divine purpose. It is very important then that we individually should conform as much as possible to the divine instructions set forth in the Holy Writings. Because to the degree that we do that, on the one hand, we fulfill our own destiny and our own endowment, individual, unique, not to be confused with anybody else's contribution. And we assure that that which has been placed within us that has not been placed within any other soul will have its expression in the overall unfoldment of the divine plan. Not only do we deprive ourselves if we fall short in this task, but we deprive society of that particular unique expression and reflection of Baha'u'llah which only shines from your face. The collective contribution that the community of the Most Great Name makes in this sense, its impact upon the rest of society. It causes us to align ourselves one with another so that we become a mighty mirror, a united mirror. Now we can all have our different points of view and be facing all different directions and the light that we reflect will be chaotic. But if we come into conformity with these basic requirements, this incessant call of Abdu'l-Bahá, Shoghi Effendi, to harmonize our thoughts, to draw close together in love and unity, then we become a solid front and the image from on high will be reflected in its completeness through the image and expression of united purpose that all the Baha'is show in their activities. Fortunate for us, this is the day of that most mighty grace of God, when we've been given instruments that explain clearly to us how to walk and where to go. In the past, there was this fervor, but there were not the God-given instruments to direct its operations. And Baha'u'llah has created instruments through which His Spirit continues to operate in the world after His passing. And it was Shoghi Effendi who forged these instruments, who forged the first local assemblies and national assemblies. And then, about 17 years after he assumed the guardianship, he set these instruments to their divine purpose, the fulfillment of Abdu'l-Bahá's injunctions in the divine plan to propagate this spirit, to share this divine energy with mankind, to attract the waiting souls who would be the elements and instruments for carrying it forward through this century, through this formative age, to the time of its destined fruition in the golden age of the faith. We're here in midstream. We are the formative age Baha'is. We are the formative Baha'is of the formative age, if you will, so to speak. We are the generation of the half-light. We have some of it, and we're excited about a lot of it, but the forces of darkness are lapping at our souls all the time, and we live in a very dangerous period. And from what we read in the writings, we don't know how dangerous it is. We are kind of lulled and soothed by its beautiful qualities and its alluring attraction and its tinsel and its glow. And having been born in such a time, we don't know much else. And we have to imbibe a lot of spiritual guidance in order to orient ourselves enough to be able to distinguish about between what is good and what is evil. We even have prayers that say, I know not that which profits me or harms me. Well, this is one of the states of progress of the human soul, we're told in the writings. Abdu'l-Bahá talks about stages of the soul. He says the first stage is the stage of the concupiscent soul. That's the soul wedded to evil, plain, simple, animal, brute-like life, not concerned about what God may or may not think, in fact, not even concerned if God exists or doesn't exist, just simply living for their own comfort, abiding by certain rules, because if they don't, it will impinge upon their freedom to enjoy themselves. So we enjoy ourselves to some limit, within limits. Souls not to be trusted in the dark, if you will. Then he says we move to a second stage. In this second stage, through the blessings of God, an occasional spark of illumination comes into the soul of man. And the human soul is startled. That solid picture of the world as his animal jungle is disturbed. There is something else bothering now and again. And gradually a concept of light forms, that there is something higher, it seems. There's something outside of me that has an attraction and a beauty which I had not formerly suspected existed. And when this light comes into my habitation, on the one hand I'm thrilled by the light, and on the other hand I am astonished by the dirt on the floor and all around everywhere where I live. You know, as we let the light of the faith into our souls, we have to clean our houses. If we're going to open the window and get fresh air, we're going to have a lot of scrubbing to do. And of course, the more light that comes in, the more we find things that we cleaned that already, but somehow it's not clean anymore. It needs more scrubbing and more polishing. Then Abhava says the soul then is gradually drawn towards a firmer attraction to God. And at that stage, it becomes what he calls an inspired soul. And there's where he mentions that the soul becomes inspired with the difference between good and evil. It knows, it feels in itself, this is inappropriate and this is acceptable to God. It takes one step in that direction and says, this is not good. He feels the heart cooling off. He knows by his own nature, inherently now begins to realize what's good for it and what's bad for it. And that's a great grace from God, because after that there's some security and hopefulness. About the earlier stage, God says in the Quran that he won't swear by the self-accusing soul, which is that second stage. If you want another translation, the Guardian has translated it as irascible, the irascible soul. Concupiscence, then irascibility, and then inspiration, this stage of inspiration. Not inspiration like the prophets get, but inspiration of what's acceptable and what's not, and how to proceed. And that leads gradually to winning the good pleasure of God, and leads to the stages of certitude, and leads to the stations of constancy, and finally the soul becomes a soul of the kingdom. These various stages are described in the writings in different ways, as you know from your own study. So we want to know about these forces of light and these forces of darkness. What are they? What do they consist of? How do they act upon us? How can we become a lamp luminous with the bright energies of life? How can we avoid the pitfalls of the negative and that which draws us down and obscures our vision. The origin of the forces of light is clear to all of us, that this comes from God through the manifestations of God. In the writings, we find a progression. We can't go into all the quotations, but I'll recite for you the progression. And you see, you think of the quotations that you know and the things that may support such a point of view. We have the manifestation revealing the word, which releases forces. Those forces, he tells us, have had their brightest expression in the production of the covenant. The covenant then has become an instrument for the release of further forces. And those forces have given rise, as they crystallize, to the administrative order of the cause of God. That administrative order, we're told, in its turn, releases further forces or energies, which will gradually give birth to the world order of Baha'u'llah. And in that condition, certain other energies and forces will come into play and be released, leading to the establishment of the world civilization promised by Baha'u'llah. In other words, the appearance of these forces of light, thank you, these divine energies, is progressive. It's not all one time and finished, but all of the individual acts on an individual level of our very daily acts, as we conform ourselves to the pattern given in the writings, we release in ourselves, we attract to ourselves the energy associated with those patterns. And we become energized. And all of us know that from the teaching work especially. Whenever we've gone teaching, or we've prayed to go, or when we've had an opportunity to, in some small way, be a mirror of God's light, talking to some other soul, teaching them, how we become animated. How we say things that we never dreamt of saying before, or never thought or planned before we went out to teach that we would say. New things, yet drawn from the writings and from the inspiration that we've received from them. So each stage has new gifts. Each stage of development in the Baha'i community, and by development we should understand, I think, greater unity and love amongst the Baha'is. Now you could say, well, each stage, if the Baha'is studied more, we'd know more, that would be better. But that knowledge has to lead to some kind of action. That the prayer, the meditation, and the study of the faith must result in effective action. That's the sign that it's been done the right way. That's the sign that we're moving in the right direction. And that correct action, part of it is the way we associate with each other. And the support and spiritual upliftment we derive in each other's company. This is the characteristic of the people of Baha. If we are going to be the nucleus for the establishment of the, not union of mankind, but unity of mankind, these qualities have to dominate in our community. If they don't, Abdu Baha says, we will be dispersed. And of course, Baha'u'llah said he will even draw up others to act in this way on his behalf. This is not, again, the revelation doesn't return void to him. We're all part of a process. And this can lead then to the fulfillment of his purpose. Now, we're told that the generative power of the Spirit was breathed into the pen. This is one from the Prayers and Meditations. Baha'u'llah talks about this. A generative power causes birth. In our case, it causes rebirth. We've had a physical birth, then Abdu Baha says the time comes we need to have a spiritual birth. We need to be born into the kingdom. We need to be born into a consciousness of the sovereignty of Baha'u'llah. We need to become subjects of that dominion of his law and his teachings. Willingly, we need to enter into that kingdom. We need to study the laws and the principles and verities animating and directing that kingdom, then we become inhabitants of another state. We become citizens of Baha'u'llah's world order. We become the expressions in the darkness of that kingdom of light that we belong to. The power of spirit breathed into the pen. Then the pen breathes a new life into every human frame and instills into every word a fresh potency. And all created things proclaim the evidences of this worldwide regeneration. Generative power of the spirit breathed in the pen, then the pen causes this generation, regeneration, to spread in the world. He says that every single letter is endowed with regenerative power to bring into existence this new creation. Now we're going back, we're drawing again, but now in a more progressive manner from the first quotations that we read. He talks about the light of divine names shed on the inmost reality of each and every created thing. Now this is a whole study in itself, the analysis of how these divine powers crystallize within us, how they suggest the divine principles and verities of the faith, how as we meditate on them, as we think about them, as we make them our own, as we allow them to reorient ourselves, they crystallize from murky, some kind of murky, unclear mental outlook, these things to the influence of these divine words as we read them and think about them, they crystallize in consciousness, and the matter becomes clarified for us, if you will. Clarified in the sense of begins to shed light upon the matter. And we become, in our nature, like crystals, which refract light instead of absorb it, which reflect it, which pass it on, become glass-like. This, I think, is very much connected to the crystalline nature of human spirit. It's crystalline in the sense of that example of capturing light and refracting it in its own particular way. This is another subject that's worth exploring, looking in the writings. How the heart or soul of man crystallizes into a mirror which captures the images of higher forms and the higher worlds. And Abdu'l-Bahá talks about this sometimes. He says, for instance, he says that the teacher, when teaching, the heart becomes a magnet that attracts the mysteries of the kingdom, or the images, he says sometimes, of the kingdom. Truths and understandings that we couldn't conceive of before appear in the mirror of our inner being, and we're able to observe them. And he says that these pictures that God paints on the soul, so to speak, he said, now we should learn how to express those in our daily life. Again, we're gathering the images of divine virtue, of divine actions. And we translate these into deeds in the world as we can, as best we can. And we try to become the embodiment of those basic qualities that we understand adorned the being of Abdu'l-Bahá. So we want to look upon our neighbors with a bright and friendly face, and we want to radiate the love of the kingdom. We want to be a source of attraction to other souls. That, by virtue of the degree to which we are an embodiment or an incarnation of this spiritual light that comes from the manifestation of God. Does this sound very far from what any of us can do? Abdu'l-Bahá says in the Divine Plan says we must become, the teachers of the cause must become incarnate light. And he says that they should shine with this white light from their heads to their feet. In the gleanings we're told in one of the tablets that the reality of man has been made a mirror for God's own self. Now we know that the self of God standing within man is the image of the manifestation of God and is the image, therefore, of the names and attributes of God. And we're told that the human reality, singular in creation, is the place of appearance of all the divine names and attributes. That every human reality is expressive of all the divine names and attributes. That other created things are expressive of some of the divine names and attributes. But that the human reality is an index for all of these divine qualities. Now, this presents us with an interesting quandary. We are all images and likeness of God, who is singular and one. And yet we're told that each of us is distinct, absolutely different from every other one of us. We even look different. We act different. Now, how do we reconcile these two things? Abdu'l-Bahá explains in one of the tablets, he says that there is a dominant name of God in each one of us. There is something, one of these divine names, that has more position, is more preeminent in our characters than the others. Now, if we're all to be different, I understand from the simple calculation that I can make that the rest of the expression of the divine names is going to be different. So if you have a pie and you have one big portion of divine name, this particular name dominates your, the name of God the wise, or the humble, or whatever it happens to be, the merciful, the generous, the kind, the compassionate, or God the avenger, I don't know, maybe some of us. And then you have a little bit of something else, and you have others, and all of these are like the secondary chords in the music of your being, the different chords, the triads of the expression of these names. And this is the thing that makes us each different, that no one is the expression of all these divine names at the same time, in the same way as the manifestation of God is. But we do reflect according to this inherent gift of God, that particular spiritual DNA, if you want, divine DNA, which characterizes how, codes how you're going to be different from everybody else. And I always like to remember in this connection a tablet of Baha'u'llah in the Gleanings, where he says that he talks about what will be the activity of the companions of the Crimson Arc, of the souls, the detached souls, when they go to the other world. And it says that they will, one of the things they will do is they will witness the reality of every detached soul, of every sanctified soul. Now, we're told in the next world we don't see God. We do see the manifestation. If we're lucky, we come to his court and we see him. I don't know how often or how much, but he says these sanctified souls, they are like the face of God in a sense. Each one of these great souls that's gone before will be expressive of the power of God, of the names of God, in a unique way. And that will always be attractive to us. Just as when we meet outstanding, interesting Baha'is in our travels, in our activities, it's always exciting to us. That will be the same way in the other world. To the degree that we're not self-centered and expressive of our own personal darkness, but we're expressive of the divine light. In case there was any confusion, he says in one place, in one of his tablets, Baha'u'llah says, all good comes from God and all evil comes from you. So here we have this growing image of luminous beings that we are supposed to become in the midst of this process. To move on a little to some of the comments of Shoghi Effendi, he talks about, in one of his messages back in 1941, he says, the faith of Baha'u'llah, and he characterizes it as that priceless gem of divine revelation, enshrining the Spirit of God, incarnating his purpose for mankind in this age. Now think of this image in the same, in the light of what we're discussing. You have a faith, he says, which is a priceless gem of revelation, of divine revelation. It enshrines, it is a shrine for the Spirit of God. In other words, the Spirit of God is appearing within the cause of Baha'u'llah in this day. in this world. And this Spirit incarnates itself to fulfill this purpose. It's fixed ways in which it incarnates itself. Now, how does it incarnate itself? Again, we're back to us. To the degree that we become the recipients and the expressions of this divine effulgence, of this divine power, this divine Spirit, to that degree, that Spirit becomes incarnated in this world. To the degree to which we associate with each other in accord with these divine teachings, instruments are forged, agencies appear, and these processes of the administrative order, which is the very purpose of God in this day, begin to operate and extend themselves and develop. Now, sounds like it's something difficult to understand, but on the other hand, when you think, what are the processes? They're the things that we're always engaged in. Increasing the number of believers, producing more active supporters of the faith through deepening and consolidation, raising up local spiritual assemblies, developing them in their services, seeing to their incorporation, purchasing properties for the cause, building of mashrigal askars, developing Baha'i literature, seeing to its translation into hundreds of languages, developing travel teaching programs, developing summer schools and institutes. All of these are what Shoghi Effendi calls the processes of the administrative order. And they are the outer expression. They are the incarnation of this animating Spirit. They are the expression of this energy that we're talking about in the world. And they have a dynamic influence. Shoghi Effendi calls on the Baha'is to do something. He says, by the Spirit released by this convention which you've just attended, you are assured of the confirmations to achieve what you're called upon to do. Here's something happening. Just the fact that we gather and listen and rehearse together here these quotations releases tremendous capacities within us. It will create possibilities for us to see things in new ways. Every time we look at these things, you know, this is the same for all of us. He refers in one of his messages to the Bab as the fountainhead from whence the vitalizing energies of a newborn revelation had flowed. This is again, vitalizing energies. He's characterized these energies in so many different ways. Now, you've probably seen these, but if you start to make a list of them, it becomes very exciting how he varies it each time, how he characterizes them. He talks about a dynamic process, divinely propelled, possessed of undreamt of potentialities, world embracing in scope, world transforming in its ultimate consequence, had been set in motion on that memorable night. Now he's talking about the declaration of the Bab. From the very beginning, this process has its origin. Referring to revelation, and this is in reference to the Bab, he says, Shoghi Effendi's written and God Passes By, the man-child mentioned in the book of Revelation, destined to rule all nations with a rod of iron, had released through his coming the creative energies which, reinforced by the effusions of a swiftly succeeding and infinitely mightier revelation, were to instill into the entire human race the capacity to achieve its organic unification, attain maturity, and thereby reach the final stage in its age-long evolution. Again, he says, it is the creative energies which his revelation has released in the year 60, and later reinforced by the successive effusions of celestial power vouchsafed in the year 9. Year 60 was the declaration of the Bab. Year 9 was the experience of Baha'u'llah and the Sayyid Shal, the intimation of his divine mission. And the year 80, the year of Baha'u'llah's declaration, 1280 in the Muslim lunar calendar, 1863 in the calendar that we're familiar with. Vouchsafed, this is, he's reinforced the effusions of celestial power vouchsafed in the year 9 and the year 80 to all mankind, that have instilled into humanity the capacity to attain this final stage in its organic and collective evolution. How Shoghi Effendi takes us away from any small, petty view we might have of the cause of God as an interesting religion with books that are very nice to read and prayers that you can say, and we're trying to get more members because if we get more members in the world, it'll be better for the world. And how he takes it away from that and tells us, he lets us see inside, from God's side, what's actually happening. He tells us nothing short of a power that is born of God can succeed in establishing the oneness of mankind. It's not coming about because the people are gradually becoming more enlightened because they study and they're more scientific and they're more this and they're more that. In fact, in the process of becoming more scientific, they've become increasingly more dangerous and more sinister. Not that that would have to be that way, but that's been the result of a century of irreligion and science combining forces, of science becoming like a religion, in a sense, but with no moral keel to keep it on course. He talks about Baha'u'llah's ministry, a ministry which by virtue of its creative power, its cleansing force, its healing influences, and the irresistible operation of the world-directing, world-shaping forces it released, stands unparalleled in the religious annals of the entire human race. He talks about the cause itself. From it radiated wave after wave. This is Baghdad when Baha'u'llah was reviving the community in Baghdad after his return from Sulaymaniyah, when the Babis had become fallen into such a slump. It was really the decay and end of the Babi dispensation in that sense. What usually took 1,000 years in other religions, they were able to accomplish very quickly when Baha'u'llah was removed from their midst. From it radiated wave after wave, a power, a radiance, and a glory, which insensibly reanimated a languishing faith, sorely stricken, sinking into obscurity, threatened with oblivion. From it were diffused day and night, and with ever-increasing energy, the first emanations of a revelation which in its scope, its copiousness, its driving force, and the volume and variety of its literature was destined to excel that of the Bab himself. He's mentioned in Unfolding Destiny, referring to some development in the Baha'i administration. He says, this is a clear indication of those hidden and transforming influences, which from the source of Baha'u'llah's mystic strength continue to flow with ever-increasing vitality. Not less because we're moving away from the time Baha'u'llah lived, but more because greater receptivity is being created in the human race through the progressive unfoldment of these energies, through their crystallization into more human souls, and through the collective influence that produces on mankind. Greater outpourings of vitality. Far from moving away from the most exciting time of the Baha'i faith, we're moving directly into it. It's ahead of us still. I don't mean heroic age. I mean the time where the formative age we live in. Heroic age, I don't know how exciting it would have been for us, because most of us wouldn't have known anything about it if we'd lived any place but right in the heart of the cause. Again, he describes this. He says, a revelation which flowing out from Baha'u'llah's travailing soul and propagating itself as far as the ends of the earth, infused into the entire body of mankind its boundless potentialities, and is now, under our very eyes, shaping the course of human society. Another dimension to a study of the whole question of forces is how the revelation acts in the two ways of producing a process of integration and a process of disintegration. The author of both the processes is Baha'u'llah. But you have one of them acting within the aegis or under the aegis of the Baha'i community itself, which is this integrating process. Slow and at times imperceptible, Shoghi Effendi says. Very slow in its character at times, although it's getting very dramatic recently. For us anyway, looking at it from our vantage point. And then this process of disintegration. which means that whatever doesn't in its inmost spirit conform to the will and purpose that God has stated in his revelation, which is the very pattern of all of this energy that's moving in the world, it will produce, in instead of light in it, it will produce fire in it. It has this dual effect. You remember in the Agon seeing those passages where he says that the same verses produce light in the hearts of those who are attracted to God and fire in the hearts of the enemies. It's one energy. There's only one God. It just depends how you read it, how you accept it into your life, how people respond to it. And those that don't respond positively in a favorable way, they become part of this process of disintegration. And some of them are very good at it. They're tearing down nations. And the receptivity on the parts of the souls of humankind. We're going to get in and try to fix it without the faith, make it better. He says what will happen is we will be caught in it. We'll be caught in that. It would lead to our own destruction. He calls on the community to make itself independent of those processes. He said nobody else is dedicating themselves to the process of integration except us. And we need to keep our focus on that. Although we watch and see the signs and evidences of these other things happening in the world. He talks about the evidences, again, of invincible power, which the Almighty has chose to invest this faith from its inception. He says that the cause associated with the name of Baha'u'llah feeds itself upon those hidden springs of celestial strength, which no force of human personality, whatever its glamour, can replace. Been lots of very great personalities in the world since Baha'u'llah's coming who haven't done anything for the Baha'i faith. And yet, he raises up the likes of us to help him. It's almost as if Baha'u'llah wants it to be that way. He doesn't want the cause to progress because of great prominent people helping it. But no one afterwards could say, of course the Baha'i faith is progressing because so-and-so became a Baha'i and that was... Now the cause is becoming big enough that certain of these souls can come under its shadow and do all right, you know. But look what king he's chosen to start with. Off in the middle of the ocean, but pure-hearted there. Okay, we need to go to the forces of darkness for a few minutes. What are the forces of darkness? Now, the forces of darkness, someplace here, Shoghi Effendi says, they, the Baha'is, should open their eyes to the existing conditions. Study the evil forces that are at play. And then with a concerted effort arise and bring about the necessary reforms. Reforms that shall contain within their scope the spiritual as well as social and political phases of human life. As we're in the process of doing. Social and economic development, literacy, of course the diffusion of the faith, the light of the faith itself in the heart of all of that. If you take the time to study the opus of Shoghi Effendi's published letters, you'll find that he makes reference to many different forces of darkness. For instance, you'll find a quote like, "The forces of irreligion are weakening the moral fiber and undermining the foundations of individual morality." The forces of irreligion he refers to. Another place he says that he speaks about the baneful forces of materialism. Another place he talks about the explosive forces of a blind and triumphant nationalism. In different ways he collects these and places them in different contexts. But basically, of the survey that I made, I came up with
32, I think there's a few more since then that I found, but these are the ones I have in this older list, 32 forces of darkness. I'll read them for you so you'll know that we're not talking about goblins and other things like that. These are worse. Irreligion. Now, I put them in some kind of schematic order, but the ones that seem to be the heaviest and the darkest are at the top. And irreligion and materialism are certainly at the top of the whole group. Materialism is very subtle. He speaks of it usually in terms of cancer. You know what happens to you if you get cancer? Well, the same thing happens to you if you get materialism. Irreligion, materialism, nationalism, racialism, communism, atheism, unbelief. Some of these, of course, are synonymous in one way or another. Secularism, paganism, fanaticism, superstition, priestcraft, orthodoxy, sectarian tendencies, prejudice, corruption, immorality, the dark forces of nature, meaning the lower side of man. Violence, disorder, rebellion, revolt, anarchy, inharmony, disunity, separation, schism, disintegration, hatred, suspicion, despair, reaction, and decay, the dark forces mentioned by Shoghi Effendi. Well, to clear the air a little bit, I'll mention some of the forces of light, and then we'll go back and consider that. Acts or qualities which reflect light or channel creative energies, love, unity, harmony, faith, detachment, universality, godliness, wisdom, moderation, nonviolence, freedom from prejudice, righteousness, chastity, purity, holiness, peace, trust, hope, fellowship, acquiescence, magnanimity, integrity, reconciliation, orderliness, happiness, consideration, courtesy, humility, pacification, integration, justice, truthfulness, uprightness, trustworthiness, compassion. Now, you can collect a longer list than that, but I at least made a few more on that list than were on the forces of darkness. This is give an impression of the scale of things here. We have, Shoghi Effendi wrote early on in his ministry, we have but to turn our eyes to the world without, to realize the fierceness and the magnitude of the forces of darkness that are struggling with the dawning light of the Abha revelation. Nations, though exhausted and disillusioned, have seemingly begun to cherish anew the spirit of revenge, of domination and strife. Peoples convulsed by economic upheavals are slowly drifting into two great opposing camps, with all their menace of social chaos, class hatreds, and worldwide ruin. Races, alienated more than ever before, are filled with mistrust, humiliation, and fear, and seem to prepare themselves for a fresh and fateful encounter. Creeds and religions, caught in a whirlpool of conflict and passion, appear to gaze with impotence and despair at this spectacle of unceasing turmoil. Assured, again he says, assured and content that he is exerting his utmost in a conscious effort to approach nearer every day the lofty station to which his gracious master summons him, let him, the individual believer, let him turn to his second task, and with befitting confidence and vigor assail the devastating power of those forces which in his own heart he has already succeeded in subduing. So we've got a great holy war to fight out there. Muhammad has said that the most holy war, however, is fought on the plane of the soul between the higher and lower aspects of our own nature. That's a struggle to the death. If we get to the stage where we can subdue our lower nature, then he says we must turn to the task of helping others. Fully alive to the unfailing efficacy of the power of Baha'u'llah, fully alive to it, and armed with the essential weapons of wise restraint and inflexible resolve, let him wage a constant fight against the inherited tendencies, the corruptive instincts, the fluctuating fashions, the false pretenses of the society in which he lives and moves. 1927, the Guardian calling the Baha'is to their active service. To an individual who had written about making some interesting study of one sort or another in the faith, he says, "No true and faithful Baha'i should in this day remain idle or seek what would give him comfort or even inner satisfaction." Did we hear that? Shouldn't remain idle, but he shouldn't also seek what would give him comfort or even inner satisfaction. There's certainly things we could do in the faith that would give us inner satisfaction. Are they the things that are required of the Baha'is now? No. I would like to write a detailed history of some of the early martyrs of the faith. But it'll take me about 10 years and I'll have to be into the archives all the time doing it and so on. Is that what we need to do now? Maybe some souls have that mission, I don't know. But in general, we should look and see what are the most important tasks to be performed. He goes on after he says, or even inner satisfaction, he says, "We should be constantly assailing the forces of darkness that have enveloped the earth and hasten the dawn of the new day foretold by Baha'u'llah." Then he says this most extraordinary thing in another letter. He says, "As to evil, there is no doubt that it exerts a very strong influence, both in this world and in the next." That's in a compilation on good and evil. That was in 1934 he wrote that. Then he talks about National Assemblies. This was published in Messages to Australia and New Zealand early on. He says, "Nothing short of this divine spirit, as expressed through the self-sacrificing and confident labors of the Friends, could have so effectively subdued those forces which every now and then threatened to undermine the foundations of your assembly." Forces of darkness slipping in to the administration, and thus overthrow the entire system of the administration in your land. We may well believe we who are called upon to experience the operation of the dark forces destined to unloose a flood of agonizing afflictions, that the darkest hour... We've got the other side of this here. "That the darkest hour that must precede the dawn of the golden age of our faith has not yet struck." A few more thoughts. He says, "Regarding your questions relative to the condition of those people who are described in the gospel as being possessed of devils, this should be interpreted figuratively. Devil or Satan is symbolic of evil and dark forces yielding to temptation." So he's talking about souls that are described there as being possessed of devils. When our lower self, our more animal side of our character, dominates in our person, we can say that the devil is in charge, so to speak. These are very picturesque terms posters that the Christians draw about these things from time to time, you see. We say we don't believe in the devil. We don't believe that he's out there. We believe he's in here. We don't believe in hell as a place you can go to. It's something you live with inside yourself in case you don't arrange your affairs properly. These are concepts we say we don't believe, but we have there's some element of them that we need to understand is there. Not to be frightened of them, but to at least be fearful. If you will. I mean, if we can use them as an incentive to good and not as the cause of us feeling depressed and morose, then they're useful to us. Chogyi Effendi says in another letter, he says, "Evil forces do take control of our life." but it is within our power to free ourselves from falling under their influence. We are not weak in the face of such things. We have the power of God to come to our assistance, to help us, but the struggle goes on. Now, what are some of these forces that he particularly mentions? This is another interesting one that I wanted to share with you. There are dark forces. This is a letter of the Guardian again. There are dark forces in the world today of despair and hatred and suspicion. Despair and hatred and suspicion. The believers must, as the Master said, turn their backs on these and their faces to him, confident of his help and protection. How do we deal with dark forces? Turn your back on them and face him. Endowed with these energies of light, do battle. And then he says, when the Baha'is permit the dark forces of the world to enter into their own relationships within the faith, they gravely jeopardize its progress. Now, what are some of these forces that we read in that list? That if we become expressive of those forces, then our relationship with our fellow Baha'is is going to really come apart very quickly. Either that or we'll make great spiritual giants out of them, one of the two. Now, he says something here that I think is worth all of us pondering on at length. He says the world is full of evil and dark forces, and the friends must not permit these forces to get hold of them. It's not finished. I want us to think about that first. He says, the world is full of evil and dark forces, and the friends must not permit these forces to get hold of them by... And then he names some things that if we do them, the forces are going to get hold of us. He says, by thinking and feeling negatively towards each other. Now see if you can sleep tonight. Go ahead. He doesn't say by speaking and acting negatively towards each other. No. He says by thinking, and worse yet, by feeling negatively towards each other. How can I control how I feel? These terrible Baha'is. It's not that they're terrible, but my coordinator is something that I don't know how to deal with, you know. How many times a day do we feel negatively about someone? How many times a day do we think negatively about someone? To what degree are we, what does he say? Gotten hold of. The dark forces get hold of us. And then we're tired and we don't feel so good and all kinds of things. But anyway, this is worth thinking about. This is the front line of action right now. We don't have to worry about going out there and battling nationalism and other great forces in the world. We can just work on this thinking and feeling negatively about each other. If we get started on that one, we'll already have a big change in our own lives. Basically, that, I think, is a good point to end on. It's not the highest point of all, but it's a very practical one. And the whole purpose of the consideration of this question of forces in our lives is to see how this can enthuse us to make greater efforts, how it can clarify the way we look at ourselves and our relationships with others, so that we can see what steps we need to take so that we're moving in a positive way, so that these concepts and these principles are crystallizing in that chaos of our uncoagulated spirit, if you will. And then on the base of that, on that foundation, on that firm and solid foundation, to carry out our activities and our services. Now, we know all of you that are here have chosen service to the cause. You have cut yourself from whatever other activities you had in the world to come here to the thresholds of the shrine in the service of the cause, in the service of the house of justice. So already you have moved so far forward in this battle, you know, against the forces of darkness, that you don't want to miss any opportunities, any chances that come your way to consolidate that position and to be sure that the quality of your service is what you want it to be while you're here in the proximity of the shrine. To not fall back into criticism. To not become despondent with your own shortcomings. Because you should protect yourself from that as well. If you have shortcomings, take them to the shrine and leave them. They may not stay there, but I know. Somehow, like cats, they come home again. So sometimes I know you feel, you go to the shrine and you say, well, what am I going to offer to Baha'u'llah today? How about these shortcomings? I really like leave these here for you. You know, the master, years ago I heard that the master, and I don't know where to find this text, so please don't ask me after class. The master said that the meaning, the spiritual meaning of burnt offerings, you know, they had these sacrifices, they said, in the old days. They used to put the animals on the stone and then a fire would come down out of heaven and this would be one of the proofs. And it was part of the ritual of the Judaism and the older religions. So they asked her, what is the sense of this thing? You know? So the master is said to have explained that the meaning of that is this, that the altars is the human heart. And the lambs and the ewes, these animals that they put, are human passions and desires. And when we put those on the altar of our heart as an offering to God, which is this same concept of leaving your shortcomings at the shrine, really, put it on the altar of your heart, then the fire of the love of God comes down from heaven and burns them off the face of the heart. This is the miracle of these burnt offerings. And it's a sign of faith when you're able to finally get those animals up there onto the altar. And then you trust that God will do the rest. He's promised. So, now I hope you will all pray for me, please. Because I have overextended my words beyond my deeds tonight, and I'm in trouble. But this is the part of the problem of giving talks on the Baha'i Faith. I think we all need each other's prayers and to each other's encouragement, each other's appreciation, when we really think that all of us have taken this step to come here and serve the cause. That in itself is a core of spiritual quality in the center of the heart of each of us, and we should appreciate it to the maximum in each other and make sure that we can help each other to serve, because that's going to be so much easier than anything else, any other approach we might use. So I think I have to give the class back to the chairman. It's getting very late here. And we look forward to seeing you on other weeks with some of these interesting talks that are coming up.